There were still quite a lot of things about Angelic Panda that he hadn't figured out. Of course, the fact that he couldn't figure them out, even with all of the advantages he enjoyed, even here in Zion, despite his limitations compared to other realms, probably helped explain how she'd managed to avoid the Inquisition's notice for so long. It also meant he had absolutely no idea how she'd contacted the other five families she'd hidden away right here in Zion. The one thing he had decided upon where that was concerned was that, once more, she was the one who'd done the contacting. He'd finally managed to locate Lisbeth and Thomas Wilson, and studying the take from the bugs he'd planted on Lisbeth, he'd realized Samuel Wilson must have seen what was coming but been unwilling or unable to inform the rest of the circle. Merlin found it difficult to conceive of what could have kept a man of Wilson's obvious integrity from passing that information on, but he was fairly confident that was what had happened. Yet it was equally apparent that Angelic had been aware of it. From all indications, it was she who'd initiated her original contact with the other families, and who'd smuggled them into hiding without ever discussing it with their husbands and fathers. Those poor bastards are probably wondering whether their wives and children have managed to evade Clinton, so far at least, or whether the bastard has them in custody somewhere already, Merlin thought grimly. God, I hadn't realized how sadistic he really is. If the Circle, or Wilson at least, has seen this coming for as long as I think, then that sick, twisted son of a bitch has been watching them squirm for months. And from everything I've been able to see, he's been enjoying the hell out of it. Jaspar Clinton had no idea how fortunate he was that he never left the temple's precincts. If he ever did, if he ever once strayed into an area where Merlin could get at him without risking triggering some unidentified sensor system or automated response in the temple, he was a dead man. There was no question, no hesitation about that on Merlin's part. But it also wasn't something that was going to happen. Not anytime soon, at any rate. Not soon enough to save any of Clinton's present list of victims. Merlin had been forced to accept that, and his focus now was on getting those family members and as much of the rest of Angelic's organization, however large or small it was, as he could, out of the temple lands. Which was rather the point of this evening's visit, he reminded himself, and reached for Jevon's coat.
"Good evening, Ibrahim," Angelic Panda said with a welcoming smile.
"Good evening, my dear." Merlin bent over her hand once again, kissing it gallantly.
"Maybe one reason I think of myself as Merlin instead of Nemu," he thought, "is that Nemu was never interested in other women."
Merlin, on the other hand...
He set that consideration aside once more, although he really wasn't sure whether it was legitimately a case of Merlin being interested in other women, or of Merlin being interested in the opposite sex, whichever sex that happened to be at the moment, or of Merlin having discovered something about himself that Nemu had never suspected about herself, or simply of Merlin finding something else to worry about that wouldn't have mattered to anyone else on the entire planet.
"I'm glad you could join us this evening," Angelic continued. "Although I'm afraid company is going to be a bit sparse on a night like this."
"I'm not surprised," Merlin cocked his head, listening to the wind howl keen around the eaves of Angelic's townhouse. The temperature outside was 8 degrees below zero, 8 Fahrenheit degrees below zero, and still falling. The wind was gusting to speeds of almost 40 miles per hour, too, and Merlin was grimly aware that even as he stood in the comfortable warmth of Angelic's townhouse, men and women, yes, and their children, were freezing to death, literally, outside it. He knew about the gardener's shed on Angelic's grounds and about the 4 poor families who had moved into it this winter. He knew how she'd weatherproofed it the way she did every winter. how she'd made sure there was enough coal for the ceramic stove she'd had installed. And he knew how, despite her best efforts, the members of those families were huddled together, sharing body warmth as well as the life-giving heat of that stove. They would be cold, stiff, and miserable, and he doubted any of them would really sleep, as violently as they were shivering. Yet, in the morning, unlike all too many of the poor huddled for warmth around the waste heat vents of the temple's environmental system, they'd be alive. "And she knows exactly what's going on out there," Merlin thought, looking at his hostess's smiling face. "The same woman who's gone to such lengths to give them the chance to survive, who's organized Wilson's communications and hidden those families of refugees somewhere here in Zion, is smiling and laughing as if she doesn't have a care in the world." He felt his admiration click up another notch, and he tucked her hand into the bend of his elbow and escorted her across the sitting room to one of the buffet tables. A servant offered him a plate piled high with choice delicacies, rolls of ham, thin slivers of rare beef, breast of wyvern and chicken, spider shrimp, olives, deviled eggs, pickles, cheese, bread. There was enough food on the table to feed the people huddled in Angelic's gardener's shed for at least a month, he reflected. And on any given morning, he knew, that was precisely where the leftovers from the previous evening's buffet went. There, and to one of the soup kitchens operated by the Order of Bedard. "And there's another thing that pisses me off," he reflected. "If any of the other original archangels was Langhorne's enabler, it was Bedard. And I know it's stupid, damn it, but I'd really prefer for her order to be as sick and twisted as the Order of Schuller, and it's not. Not anymore, anyway. Why can't the original villains of the piece still be the villains?" "I believe Marlis has kept her schedule clear for you this evening, Abraham," Angelic told him with a smile, and he smiled back. "Actually," he said quietly, turning to survey the all-but-deserted sitting room, "charming as Marlis is, and as much as I've enjoyed her company, I came to speak with you tonight." "Ah?" She cocked an eyebrow at him, and he smiled faintly. "I'm not sure." His expression was that of a man exchanging inconsequential small talk with his beautiful hostess. "But I think time is running out." He met her eyes for a moment, then looked back out across the room. "Yes, I'm afraid it is." She smiled up at him, obviously amused by whatever he'd just said, but her soft voice was ineffably sad. "I'd hoped I could get a few more people out," she went on. "Unfortunately, I can't. There's no time."
"No?"
It was his turn to raise an eyebrow, and she shook her head.
"I have a source inside the Inquisition. Clintan is moving tomorrow."
"Against you?"
Despite himself, despite even the fact that he was a Pika and not a creature of flesh and blood, Merlin couldn't quite keep the concern out of his voice and eyes.
"I don't think so," she replied. "Not immediately, at any rate. But when he starts putting people to the question..."
She let her voice trail off, and he nodded slightly, but his thoughts were racing. Unlike Angelic, he had access to an entire network of weather satellites. He knew this evening's howling wind and plunging temperatures would ease somewhat over the next couple of days, but there was another winter storm coming behind the thaw, one which was going to be at least this bad.
"Is there some place here in the city where you can go to ground for a 5 day or two?" "If I have to," she said, and then smiled faintly. "Why, is one of those Sajan-like skills of yours telling you something I don't know, Abraham?"
"Something like that," he told her with an answering smile. "The weather's going to be unusually severe for the next few days."
She looked the slightest bit skeptical, and he patted her hand with his free hand.
"Just trust me, Angelic. If we can avoid it, we don't want you or any of the others trying to travel."
She regarded him thoughtfully for a moment, then shrugged.
It's going to take a day or so for me to get the actual movement out of the city organized anyway, she said. And to be honest, it probably won't hurt to have a few more days to work with. Assuming I've been as successful as I think I have in building my bolt holes. I think you have, he assured her. Well, she looked around the sitting room for a moment, then shrugged again. I'll miss this place, she said almost wistfully. I've accomplished at least a few useful things here. I only wish I hadn't failed so completely in the end. You haven't failed, he told her quietly. She looked back up at him, and he shook his head. Trust me, the Group of Four's days, the Temple's days, are numbered. It's going to take longer than you or I would like, but it's going to happen. And people like you and Adarai Dinis are one of the reasons it is. But how many are going to die first to Brame? She asked sadly, her expression still that of a woman chatting idly with a favored guest. How many people are going to die first? Too many, he said unflinchingly. But it's not your doing or your fault, and there are going to be a lot fewer of them, thanks to you, than there would have been otherwise. So if you don't mind, instead of worrying about how completely you failed, let's just see about getting you and as many of those other people out of this alive as we can. All right? Captain Constanzo Fandis of the Temple Guard walked swiftly down the temple hallway. He wore the polished steel cuirass and scarlet tunic of the guard over a heavy woolen sweater that was just a bit too warm here inside the temple proper. His sword was sheathed at his hip, his gloves were tucked under his belt, and although he'd shed his heavy coat at the cloakroom when he entered the temple, his tall boots and the legs of his breeches were dotted with the wet spots left by melted snow. Captain Fandis's expression was not a happy one, but he was scarcely alone in that these days. In fact, he'd discovered that quite a few of his fellow guard officers were obviously on edge this morning as well, and there was something invisible in the air, something unseen, scentless, impossible to touch, yet all-pervasive. It was scarcely the first time that had been true over the 3 years since the cataclysmic failure of the attack on the heretical kingdom of Karras. That had been the sort of earthquake which came along perhaps once in 100 years, Fandis thought now. It wasn't the sort of thing a mere guard captain was supposed to be thinking, but there was no point pretending he didn't know it was true. Just as there was no point pretending that the tremors which the subsequent defection of Chisholm, Emerald, and Zebediah, and the conquest of Coruscant, had sent through the temple and the ranks of the vicarate hadn't been even more deadly in their own way. For most subjects of the mainland realms, all of those distant lands were unimportant, lost beyond the periphery of their own interests. Besides, while Karras's wealth might be the stuff of fabulous and envious legend, the island kingdom's population was surely too small to pose any threat to the power of such great realms as Desnair, Dolar, Harchang, even the Republic of Siddharmark. The very notion was ridiculous, and that completely overlooked the fact that God, in his wisdom, would never permit the aggression of such apostate and heretical lands to prosper. Yet those who wore Mother Church's orange had a somewhat different view of things. Little though they might care to admit it, and indeed many flatly refused to admit it, they knew the rebellion of the Church of Karras had found frightening echoes in the other lands of the newborn Karizian Empire. They had begun to realize, however dimly, that people like Samuel and Howard Wilson might have had a point all along. That the luxurious lifestyles and personal power to which they had become accustomed might not actually be quite so universally beloved and approved of as they'd told one another. That, in its attack on Karras, the Group of Four might just have unleashed forces which could destroy them all. Such considerations were the business of those who far outranked Captain Fandis, and he knew it. He wasn't an idiot, however,
and his assignment to the courier service had put him in an ideal position to recognize what was going on, since so many of the messages about world events passed through his hands. And even if that hadn't been true, he'd been stationed here in the temple for over 2 years now. During those years, and especially this past winter, he'd seen how things had changed since his last temple tour. He'd seen what others had seen, recognized what others recognized, and there was no doubt in his mind that Grand Inquisitor Jaspar and Fandis's own ultimate superior, Captain General Maguire, had decided they could not afford to be threatened on more than one front at a time. Which was precisely what brought Fandis here today, when he was supposed to be in his own office down in the courier service's lakeside annex. He reached a cross hallway and turned left. A pair of vicars stood by one of the windows, gazing out into the frozen early morning. Their heads popped up like startled wyverns as Fandis appeared. They actually flinched visibly before they got themselves back under control, and the captain wondered what they'd been talking about so quietly. Given the way they'd reacted to the appearance of a mere guard captain, it was probably something they shouldn't have been discussing, as far as the group of four was concerned at least, he reflected grimly. There'd been a lot of that going around lately. Constanzo Fandis had served in the Temple Guard for over 15 years, and this was his fourth tour here in the temple itself. In all those years, however, he'd never seen a winter like this one. Never seen the most senior ranks of the episcopate and the vicarate itself broken up into such ragged knots of apprehensive, all too often half-terrified men, all watching their own backs, frightened to reveal their true inner thoughts, even among their closest intimates. He saluted the vicars courteously as he strode past them. Neither acknowledged his salute. They only stared at him the way an ice wyvern perched on the edge of an ice floe might watch a circling kraken glide past. He continued down the hall, turned another corner, descended a short, broad flight of steps, and found himself outside a closed door. He paused very briefly, a hesitation that was felt more than seen, then rapped sharply.
"Yes?" a voice inquired.
"May I speak with you for a moment, Major Carnicus?" Fandis replied. "I'm afraid it's fairly important, sir."
The voice didn't reply immediately. Then,
"Enter,"
it said curtly, and the mystically powered doors slid silently open as someone waved a hand above the magic eye which commanded them. Major Jaffar Carnicus was a tallish man, with red-brown hair, bushy brows, and dark eyes. He was a bit unusual in that he held rank simultaneously in both the Temple Guard proper and in the Order of Schuler, and Fandis felt his pulse quicken slightly as he saw Carnicus's sheathed sword lying on his desk instead of being racked on the wall in his inner office.
"What is it, Fandis?" the major said with an edge of impatience.
He had the air of a man who was preoccupied. Fandis recognized that impatience, but he still took a moment to glance at the orderly sitting at his own desk in the outer office. Carnicus followed his eyes. The major's mouth tightened, obviously irritated at the implication, but then he grimaced and shook his head.
"Give us a minute, Sergeant," he said sharply.
The non-com looked up, then rose quickly.
"Yes, sir."
He managed to keep most of the curiosity out of his eyes as he stepped past Fandis, but some of it leaked out anyway. As did an undeniable flicker of relief as the doors closed behind him, shielding him from whatever had brought Fandis to visit Carnicus. The major watched the doors close, then looked back at Fandis.
"Well?"
he said brusquely, and the captain drew a deep breath.
"Sir," he said, his voice more than a little troubled, "I've just become aware of something that disturbs me. Something I thought should be drawn to the proper person's attention."
"You have, eh?"
Carnicus's eyes narrowed, and he cocked his head to one side.
And from the fact that you're standing in my office, should I assume you've decided I'm that proper person, Captain?
In a way, Fandis agreed. At any rate, you're the first one I thought of.
He let his eyes stray briefly to Carnicus's sword and flame Schulerite badge.
I see.
Carnicus leaned back and crossed his arms.
Very well, Fandis, tell me about it.
Sir, I'm the duty officer for the courier service this morning, Fandis began,
and if you're the courier duty officer, what are you doing here instead of in your office in the annex?
Carnicus interrupted harshly. He had a reputation as a demanding disciplinarian.
Sir, I was at my post when I discovered an order that looked odd to me,
Fandis said, clearly choosing his words with care.
Given the nature of that order, I felt I had no choice but to hand the duty over to Lieutenant Vernon while I came and reported it to you.
What sort of order?
Carnicus obviously doubted Fandis's judgment, which could bode poorly for the captain's future, but he was committed now.
Sir, it was an order booking passage on the morning iceboat to Lakeview.
Carnicus frowned, and Fandis hurried on.
The authorization had been logged in last night, and I probably wouldn't have noticed it if I hadn't been catching up on some of my own routine paperwork. But the reason it seemed odd to me was that there was no name listed for the passage. The space was supposed to be reserved, but there was no notation as to who the passengers were going to be. So I checked it against the order book, and there was no name listed for the officer who'd signed in the initial authorization either. Sir, as far as I can tell, the order just appeared, without anyone having officially authorized it.
What?
Carnicus's frown had deepened.
That doesn't make any sense.
No, sir, that's what I thought too.
Fandis's relief at the Major's reaction was obvious.
So I did some more checking around. And as nearly as I can tell from the form numbers, the order got inserted into the queue sometime after Langhorne's watch this morning.
You know how quiet things are then?
Yes, yes, Carnicus said,
unfolding his arms to wave one hand impatiently.
Of course I do. Go on.
Well, sir, about that time, the night duty officer logged in a long message from one of the vicars. In fact, it was long enough, and apparently important enough, that the vicar sending it personally brought it down to the annex, despite how miserable the weather was.
Fandis shrugged.
I know the weather is always miserable this time of year, but last night was especially bad. He must have been half-frozen by the time he crossed the colonnade all the way to the annex. And since the message receiving room is usually closed at that time of night, the duty officer had to roust someone out to open it for him.
Are you suggesting, Captain, that while he was opening the receiving room and logging in this message,
someone was slipping this anonymous iceboat reservation into the queue?
Carnicus didn't sound as incredulous as he might have, Fandis noticed.
Sir, I think that's exactly what happened, the captain admitted.
He shook his head, his own expression manifestly unhappy.
Major, I know we're not supposed to officially know everything that's going on. And Sir Langhorne knows I don't want to be poking my nose in somewhere it's not supposed to be. But this just doesn't make sense to me, not the way it seems to have happened, and, well, under the circumstances...
His voice trailed off, and Carnicus gave him a thin smile. Yet, for all its thinness, there was at least a little approval in it, Fandis thought.
I understand, Captain, and I appreciate the delicacy of your situation. But tell me, which vicar had this lengthy message to send at such an ungodly hour?
Silence hovered for an instant, as if Fandis realized he stood upon the brink of a precipice. That there could be no going back from this moment. Yet the truth was that he'd known that before he ever opened his mouth the first time, and so he simply squared his shoulders and looked Carnicus square in the eye.
It was Vicar Howard, sir, he said softly,
and Carnicus's eyes flashed with dark fire.
I see.
He looked at Fandis for a seemingly endless moment, then nodded sharply, pushed back his chair, and surged to his feet, reaching for his sword belt as he rose.
"Captain, if I've seemed to doubt your judgment in bringing this to me, I apologize. You did exactly the right thing. Now, come with me."
Samuel Wilson picked up his chocolate cup, cradled it in both hands, and gazed across it at his brother, sitting on the other side of the breakfast table. Samuel's eyes were speculative, and he tilted his head to one side as he contemplated Howard's expression.
"Are you ready to tell me why you invited me to breakfast this morning?" he asked.
Howard looked up from the breakfast sausage he'd been pushing aimlessly around his plate for the last 10 minutes, and Samuel smiled gently.
"I'm always happy to share a meal with my favorite brother, Howard. My only brother, now that I think about it. But you're not exactly a big fan of early rising at the best of times, and I practically have to stand over you with a club to get you to join me for breakfast. For that matter," he nodded at the fork-herded sausage making yet another perambulation around his brother's plate, "I don't think you've managed to actually eat a single thing this morning, so I have to admit to a fair amount of curiosity."
"Was I that obvious?"
Howard's answering smile was crooked.
"Actually, yes," Samuel said.
He paused for a moment, sipping chocolate, then drew a deep breath.
"Would it happen your contacts have suggested something to you that indicates we may not have a great many more breakfasts to share?"
Howard's powerful shoulders stiffened. He started to respond quickly, but then he stopped himself and gazed back at his older brother for several seconds.
"Yes," he said then. He grimaced. "I still have a few friends in the Guard, you know. One of them, I'd rather not say who even to you, warned me we're running out of time, Samuel. I think I want you to reconsider what we discussed last 5 day. Please."
"No."
Samuel's tone was gentle, almost regretful, but firm.
"Samuel, you know,"
Howard began, but Samuel raised one hand and shook his head.
"Yes, Howard, I do know. And I won't pretend I'm not terrified, that your suggestion isn't tempting, very tempting. But I can't. Whatever else may happen, whatever else I may be, I'm still a vicar of Mother Church. And I'm still a priest."
"Samuel, even the Book of Schuller makes it clear that when a situation is truly hopeless, there's no sin in—"
"I said it was tempting,"
Samuel interrupted, his tone a bit sterner.
"But you know that the passages in Schuller you're talking about have a lot more to do with illnesses than with matters of faith."
"You're splitting hairs."
Howard's voice was harder, ribbed with frustration and concern.
"Damn it, Samuel. You know what Clinton's going to do to you. To you, especially, of all people, if he gets his hands on you."
"There's a point where it doesn't matter anymore," Samuel replied. "It's only a matter of degree, Howard, and he's going to do exactly the same thing to men we've known and loved for years. Brothers, even if you and I don't share our parents with them. Should I abandon them? I'm the one who got them involved with the Circle in the first place. I've been their leader for years. Now you want me to take the easy path out and leave them to reap the whirlwind?"
"Oh, for Langhorne's sake," Howard snapped, his eyes flashing. "It's going to happen to them whatever you do, Samuel. And don't pretend you got them into this all by yourself, that they didn't know exactly what they were doing. You aren't the only grown-up in the vicarage, dammit, and don't you take that away from them, away from me."
Howard glared at his brother.
"Yes, all of us followed your lead, and I'm pretty sure at least some of the others did it for the same reasons I did, including the fact that I love you. But we also did it because you were right, because we owed God at least an attempt to reclaim his church from bastards like Clinton. Even from bastards like Trenaire, who's never been the outright sadist Clinton is. That was our choice, and we made it, and don't you dare take that away from us now."
"Howard, I—"
Samuel's voice was husky, and he broke off, gazing out at the snowy morning and blinking rapidly. Then he cleared his throat and looked back at his brother.
I'm sorry, he said humbly. I didn't mean to imply...
Oh, shut up.
The words were harsh, but Howard's voice was soft, the hard edges gentled by love, and he shook his head.
I didn't mean that the way it sounded, and I know that's not what you meant to. But that doesn't change anything. I guess that's what really pisses me off. You know as well as I do that it won't change a thing. All you're doing is being stubborn, and that's stupid.
Maybe it is, Samuel acknowledged. You could well be right. But I'm not going to give Clinton that particular satisfaction. I'm not going to face God and the archangels with someone like him thinking I killed myself because I was so terrified of what he intended to do to me.
So instead of giving him that satisfaction, you're going to give him the satisfaction of actually torturing you to death?
Howard shook his head harder.
Samuel, that's the dictionary definition of stupid.
Probably. Samuel's smile was twisted, yet there was a shadow of real amusement in it. Then the smile faded, and it was his turn to shake his head. Erek Dinis found the moral courage and faith to speak the truth when he'd been given the chance to buy an easy death with a lie, Howard. Can I do less? And can I give Jasper Clinton the weapon of my own suicide? Give him the opportunity to shout to all the world that the members of the Circle lacked the faith, in the end, to face the question and the punishment of Schuller for what we truly believed in? Let him reduce our commitment to the level of his own ambition and greed? You know he'd never have the courage to face something like this for his faith, for what he believes in. Am I supposed to tell the rest of the vicarate, the rest of God's church, the rest of God's children, that this was really only one more power struggle? One more contest over who was going to wrest political power from whom? If I do that, what happens to the next circle? To the next group of men and women who might have successfully opposed Jasper Clinton? Or his successor? Or his successor's successor? Howard Wilson looked at his brother, and for just a moment, as he heard the passion, still glowing in Samuel's voice, saw the absolute, unyielding commitment still burning in Samuel's eyes, he saw something else as well. A memory of another day when he'd been, what, 6 years old? Something like that, he thought, remembering the day in the boat, remembering watching his older brother, the older brother he longed with all his heart to emulate, bait his hook for him. It was odd. He hadn't thought about that day literally in years, but now he did, and he remembered it with such utter clarity. The Tranchar sunlight warm on his shoulders, the way he'd watched Samuel's fingers, admiring their dexterity and wishing it were his. The desultory conversation which had gone with their long, lazy fishing expedition, with the coolness radiating up off the water and chilling the boat under their bare feet, even while the thwarts grew uncomfortably hot under the honey-thick sunlight pouring down from above, and the breeze blew pollen dust and the scent of spikethorn from the shore to tickle their nostrils like rich golden incense. They hadn't caught much, he remembered, not that day. Certainly not enough for dinner for everyone, although their mother had loyally had their meager catch cleaned and broiled for the two of them. And for her, the parent whose courageous hunters and fishermen had managed to feed her after all, while their father had tried hard, so hard not to laugh. But if Howard Wilson hadn't caught many fish that day, he'd caught something else. He'd caught the great prize, the doom whale of prizes, the joyous Leviathan prize to which he had given his entire life. For while they'd fished, and the languid conversation had drifted like another breeze above the lake, Samuel had retold the stories. The wonderful stories about the archangels and about their responsibilities. About the charge Schuller had given the Wilson family. About the whispered legends that they were, might be, could be descended from Schuller himself, about the price their ancestors had paid to serve Mother Church and the solemn, joy-filled weight of duty. It hadn't been the first time Samuel had told him those tales, but that day had been different. He hadn't realized that then. Not really. In fact, he thought wonderingly, he hadn't truly realized how different it had been until this very moment. Hadn't realized that day when he'd seen the glow in Samuel's eyes and felt its twin in his own, where those tales were going to lead them both. Now he did. And he felt a bittersweet smile hover just behind his lips as that realization touched him at last. Silly, really, he thought. That was the only word for it. Silly for two boys, even Samuel couldn't have been more than 15, to be thinking such solemn thoughts. To recognize their priestly vocations in the incense of lake water and pollen, the smell of the bait jar, the paint and varnish of the rowboat. To realize, as the years passed, that that had been the day they'd truly given themselves to the task God had set for their family so many centuries before. Yet that was precisely what they had done. That golden jewel of a day, he knew now, had been the true beginning of their decision to take up the task God had sent them. And now they had come to this, and the joy of giving themselves had been touched by the terrible ice of fear, by the bitter knowledge that they'd failed, by the horror of the fate they were about to suffer in the name of the very archangel from whom those boys had decided they really must be descended. It changed everything, that fear. Transmuted joy into sorrow and hope into despair. Not despair for their own souls' ultimate fates, for neither of them questioned that for an instant, but for their failure. The writ said that all God truly asked of a man was the best he could do, and they'd done that. But it hadn't been good enough in the end, and that knowledge prickled the backs of Howard's eyes with tears. Yet as he looked into Samuel's eyes this morning, he saw the same determination still burning there, the same passion for the cause to which they had given themselves, and the same love for the younger brother who had followed his lead for so many weary years, shouldered his own share of their task's weight without protest or hesitation. There'd been times Howard had thought Samuel was hopelessly idealistic, times the younger brother had modified their plans without mentioning it to the older. Yet he'd never wavered in his own commitment or doubted for one single fleeting moment the constancy of Samuel's unwavering love for him. Their parents were gone now, thank God. Lisbeth and the children had managed, somehow, to disappear after all. And Howard himself had no wife, no children. Aside from a handful of distant cousins, they were alone once more, just the two of them, drifting again in that fishing boat. God had given them that much grace, despite their failure, and, despite their failure, they were still committed. Even now. Foolish as it undoubtedly was, it was also the truth, and Howard Wilson would not have changed that truth, even if he had known from the very first day exactly where it must lead them. And neither would Samuel. In those eyes across the table, Howard recognized the same argument he'd been trying to win for 5 days, and he knew now that it was one he wasn't going to win. There were other points he could have raised, other points he had raised more than once. Like the fact that, whatever Samuel actually did, Jaspar Clinton would proclaim whatever story, whatever version of the facts best served his own purposes. Or the fact that, in the end, even someone with Samuel's powerful faith and determination might well be brought to confess to sins he'd never committed, to renounce the things he'd fought for all his life. Or the fact that even if he later recanted his confession, Clinton would wave it in triumph anyway, once Samuel was safely dead and unable to dispute the Grand Inquisitor's claim that it proved the Inquisition's victory over the forces of Shan Wei. or the fact that, of the entire circle, only Samuel and Howard knew the truth about Angelic's involvement. That if either of them was truly broken, they could lead Clinton's inquisitors to Angelic, to all of her own contacts, to Lisbeth, Jeanette, and the boys.
"It's too much, Samuel,"
he thought, eyes burning as he remembered that rowboat.
"Too much. God may demand our willingness to die for our faith, but you always insisted he's a loving God, and you're right. And a loving God doesn't, can't demand everything else you're willing to pay. But I can't convince you of that, can I? Which is the real reason I invited you to breakfast this morning."
He felt his lips twitch in a brief, totally unanticipated smile, and shook his head mentally.
"Eternity's a long time," he told himself. "Probably long enough for you to forgive me, eventually."
"Samuel," he began out loud, then stiffened as a heavy hand pounded on the door to his suite, and he realized that, however long eternity might be, he'd just run out of time to convince his brother. Samuel's head whipped around towards the sound of that pounding fist. His face tightened, and he inhaled deeply, but his hand was steady as he set his chocolate cup aside.
"I'm afraid it's time, Howard," he said in a remarkably calm voice, never looking away from the archway into the suite's vestibule, as the fist pounded yet again.
"I love you." "And I love you too, Samuel,"
Howard Wilson whispered through his tears, as the sword he'd hidden under the breakfast table severed his older brother's spinal cord. The force of the blow hurled Samuel's corpse out of his chair. And it was only his corpse. Samuel Wilson was dead before his body reached the floor. The powerful, well-trained, loving guardsman's hand behind that blow had seen to that.
"I'm sorry," Howard told his brother, as the pounding was replaced by the high-pitched whine of one of the Inquisition's wands.
Howard didn't need the sequence of warning notes from his suite's door to tell him the lock was being overridden, but he took one more moment to kneel beside Samuel and close the startled eyes.
"Couldn't let you do it," he said huskily,
remembering lake water and sunlight, solemn joy, and the smell of God's own love for the world he'd made in the pollen and the flowering spike thorn.
"If that's murder, I'll take my chances arguing the case with God."
He traced the sign of the scepter on his brother's forehead, then brushed tears from his eyes with a hand stained with his brother's blood, stood and stepped into the archway just as the first armored guardsman came charging towards it.
"Howard Wilson, I arrest you in—"
A voice he recognized only too well bellowed from behind the charging guardsman, only to break off as Howard's first deadly thrust drove home above the first man's protective breastplate and blood fountained from a severed throat.
"Oh, fuck you, Carnicus,"
Howard snapped almost gaily across the tumbling body.
"You always were a prick."
A second guardsman backpedaled suddenly, trying to stop as he found himself facing not a startled, panicked, unarmed vicar, but a trained soldier with a weapon in his hand. Unfortunately, he didn't have time to adjust to the unexpected situation.
"And fuck Clinton, too,"
Howard said, as the tip of his sword drove past the guardsman's frantically interposed forearm and took the man cleanly through the right eye. The luxurious vestibule was suddenly filled with the stink of blood and voided bowels. Voices were raised in consternation, and Howard bounded forward. There were at least 24 guardsmen in Carnicus's party, but no more than 4 could crowd into the vestibule at once. Howard had counted on that when he'd laid his plans against this day, and he bared his teeth as he charged his foes. A third guardsman went down before the others finally got their own weapons drawn. Steel rang on steel, and yet another guardsman staggered backwards. This one was only wounded, not dead, or not yet at least. That might change yet, Howard thought, watching blood pump from the deep wound in the other man's thigh, and two of his companions split to come at the vicar from either side. Howard gave ground, retreating, stooping to snatch a dagger from the belt of the first guardsman he'd killed. He reached the archway, where no one could flank him, and stopped, sword in one hand, dagger in the other, and a deadly, deadly smile on his lips.
"Come on, boys," he invited.
Both guardsmen attacked simultaneously. The dagger in Howard's left hand parried the first thrust, driving it out and to the side, and his own sword licked out once more. His other opponent's breastplate was no protection against a sword point which went home a hand's breadth above it, and Howard turned on the sudden corpse's companion. A lightning flurry of feints and thrusts, and another guardsman was down. Howard staggered back a half step, feeling the sudden pulse of blood.
"I guess armor does help," a corner of his brain thought, as his left elbow pressed in against the deep wound the fifth guardsman's sword had opened in his ribs before he died. The wounded vicar shook his head, blinking to clear his eyes, and saw yet another guardsman coming at him. This one wore the insignia of a captain, and Howard just managed to parry the first blinding thrust.
"Yield!" Captain Fandis shouted, parrying the victor's counter-thrust in turn.
"Go fuck yourself,"
Howard gasped back, and steel grated on steel as the captain's breastplate turned a powerful thrust from the dagger in the vicar's left hand. The two men clashed in a swirl of edged metal. Swords rang, not like bells, but like the insane clangor of Shan Wei's own anvil, and Howard was taller and stronger than Fandis, and more experienced to boot. But he was also older, already wounded, and unarmored. None of Carnicus' guardsmen had ever seen a fight like it, had ever imagined they might watch one of Mother Church's vicars and a member of the temple's own guard clash in an explosion of deadly swordplay here on the temple's own sacred ground. Howard's orange cassock was a deeper, darker color as blood pulsed from his wound, but there was nothing weakened about his sword arm or the cold, focused light in his eyes. He drove Fandis back, one stride, then another, another. The captain gave ground, then stopped and counterattacked, and there was something beautiful in the brutal violence of that exchange. Something fierce, predatory, something clean. Major Carnicus was shouting, but no one could make out his words over the clash of swords, and no one was really listening either, not really. They were all watching. Watching a bleeding vicar reject the distortion of the Inquisition's power. Watching a single wounded man, a man who knew he was doomed, that the corrupt enemy he despised with all his heart was about to crush every voice of opposition in God's own church, defy a score of armed and armored foes, and smile as he did it. It was something they knew they would never forget. Something they knew they would never be allowed to share with others, and which they already knew they would share anyway, in whispers so soft not even Jaspar Clinton would ever hear them. Whatever else Howard Wilson might be, he had been one of their own, commanded some of those same men, men like Constanzo Fandis himself, now forcing their way into his suite. And as they watched his hopeless battle, his refusal to yield, they knew that whatever the Inquisition's warrant of arrest might say, he had been worthy of their obedience. That he was still worthy of it. And then, suddenly, Howard rose on his toes, spine arching, as Captain Fandis's sword drove into his chest. It caught the vicar as he was closing, and the weight and momentum of his own body combined with the power of the thrust itself to drive the blade entirely through him. He grunted and dropped the dagger, clutching at the guard of Fandis's sword as he thudded to his knees. The guardsman released the hilt almost automatically, and Wilson bent forward, folding around the agony of his death wound. But then, the fallen vicar managed to straighten. Somehow he found the strength to raise his head once more. Blood bubbled from his lips, yet his eyes found Fandis's, and there was something in them, something like gratitude. Then Howard Wilson's eyes closed forever, and he toppled forward over the sword which had killed him. 17. Brewster and Sons Warehouse, and the Temple, City of Zion, and the Northern High Road, the Temple Lands. The travel arrangements were going to be unique. The man who was currently Abraham Jevons, and he was beginning to think he really needed a program listing the team's entire roster to help him keep his identity straight on a moment-to-moment basis, had wondered exactly how Angelic intended to transport a couple of dozen people, all of them fugitives from the Inquisition, out of what amounted to the Church of God Awaiting's capital city, in the middle of winter, without seeing every one of them spotted, stopped, and arrested. In fact, however, he'd discovered she didn't intend to transport a couple of dozen people at all. She meant to move twice that many of them. A bit more than that, actually. In fact, the exact total was 57. He'd gawked at her when she first informed him of that minor point. Yet it had quickly become evident that he'd, yet again, underestimated the sheer scope of her operations. And this time around, he decided, he'd had even less of an excuse. It had been clear from the moment he first arrived in Zion that Angelic was planning on leaving the city herself, not just smuggling out the families of a few highly placed churchmen. That being the case, it should have been equally evident to him that her plans would include the escape of any members of her own organization who might have been exposed, or to whom her own disappearance might have led the Inquisition as well. He supposed that one reason it hadn't occurred to him was the sheer scale of the thing. It must have required a massive dose of what had once been called chutzpah to even contemplate an evacuation, especially in a single effort, on the scale of the one Angelic had in mind. "You're joking," he said now, quietly, standing beside her in the icy, echoing emptiness of the warehouse. Angelic had abandoned the expensive, beautifully tailored, exquisitely fashionable garments she'd worn for so many years. She'd also abandoned her long, elaborately coiffured hair, the elegant cosmetics, the jewelry, the flawlessly manicured hands. The smallish woman standing beside Jevons, her breath steaming gently in the warehouse's cold, wore quilted trousers, sensible suede boots, and a thick but utilitarian and deplorably drab woolen sweater. She was slender, true, yet she radiated a sort of compact solidness, sadly at odds with the fashionably languid, slightly fluttery, somehow ethereal Angelic. At the moment, she also wore an unbuttoned coat that looked remarkably like one of the Imperial Carisian Navy's winter weather watch coats. The thing had to weigh as much as Merlin Athrawus's cuirass, but it was undoubtedly impervious to anything as minor as a sub-zero blizzard. "Joking?" Angelic looked up at him and used one hand to smooth her now short-cropped hair. "Why should you think that, Abraham? You're telling me you actually managed to arrange all of this?" Jevons waved his hands around the warehouse. "Right under Clinton's nose?" "No, not really." Angelic gazed around the warehouse herself. Like many such buildings in Zion, the solidly built structure had been packed to the rafters at the beginning of winter, mostly with bulk foodstuffs, in this warehouse's case, although at least a quarter of its floor space had been given over to bagged glacier heart coal, while well over half of the storage yard outside it had been covered in huge piles of the gleaming black stuff from the Mountain of Light's deep mines. This late in the season, over two-thirds of the warehouse's contents had been disposed of, undoubtedly at a tidy profit, and its staff had been reduced accordingly.
As a matter of fact, she continued, returning her attention to her guest, I made most of these arrangements well before Clinton was ever confirmed as Grand Inquisitor.
She grimaced, her expressive eyes going bleak and far colder than the warehouse's interior at the mention of that name.
I've always believed in planning ahead, Abraham. Even in the days when I was foolish enough to believe not even the vicarate could be so corrupt, so stupid, as to name someone like Clinton Inquisitor. Now...
She shrugged quickly, angrily, and Jevons nodded. In the wake of her own disappearance, Angelic's information net had been largely shut down, but they scarcely needed it to confirm that her worst estimates of Clinton's intentions had been horrifyingly accurate. Not a single member of Samuel Wilson's circle in the temple or here in Zion had escaped. The handful of lower-ranked bishops and archbishops who'd managed to get out of the city before winter might still have some faint chance of evading the Inquisitors, but no one else, aside from the family members Angelic had gotten to in time, had pulled it off. It had taken 3 days to confirm Samuel and Howard Wilson's deaths, and Angelic had withdrawn to the tiny cubbyhole here in the warehouse which had replaced her luxurious townhouse. She'd closed the door very quietly behind her, and only a Pika's exquisite hearing could have detected the soft, stifled, disciplined, infinitely bitter, broken-hearted sobs which had been her companions in that dark little room. When she'd re-emerged an hour later, her eyes might have been the tiniest bit swollen, but if they were, that was the only sign of her bottomless grief. Nor were the Wilsons the only people she had to mourn. They were the only members of the circle who had truly known about Angelic's activities, but many of the others had known Madame Angelic, and many of those others had grown to be close personal friends over the years. Very few of them had held Angelic's profession against her, and most of them had learned, gradually, of her charitable activities and, especially, her contributions to the winter soup kitchens and shelters. If Samuel and Howard were lost to her forever, at least they were already dead. Her other friends, less fortunate, were in Clinton's power, and she had no illusions about what was happening to them at this very moment. And gathered together here in this warehouse were 6 families, all of them forced to live with that same knowledge.
At least they won't be gathered here much longer, Jevons thought. Thank God, this city's been bad enough from the moment I got here. Now it's 10 times worse.
The news of the Circle's arrest had hit Zion like a hammer. Like Angelic herself, the majority of the Circle's members had been active in the city's charitable activities. Many had been Bedardists or Pasquillets, affiliated with the church shelters those orders maintained. Inadequate, underfunded, understaffed, and largely ignored by their mother orders though those shelters might be, they were still the difference, literally, between life and death for many of the city's poor. And the high churchmen who had deigned to support them, who in some cases had actually served in them on a regular basis, had been deeply beloved by those same poor citizens of Zion. Others had worked with individual churches who took their obligation to care for their less fortunate brothers and sisters seriously, and they too had been known and loved by the needy in Zion. Quite aside from the citizens those vicars and archbishops had helped directly, the sincerity of their faith and compassion had been evident to the junior clergy and laymen who'd worked with them. The news that they'd been arrested for treason and heresy, that they were to be condemned, effectively already had been condemned, as secret heretics affiliated with the Carizian apostasy, not to mention all manner of unspeakable personal perversions, had stunned all of those people. It seemed impossible, on the face of it, an obvious mistake. Yet the rumors of arrest turned out to have been true, and the confessions were already beginning to surface as the Inquisitors reasoned with their prisoners.
Zion was in very quiet, very secretive tumult. No one dared say so out loud, but there were plenty of people who suspected what had truly happened. People who saw in the circle's destruction a ruthless, coldly planned and executed maneuver to silence anything which could be construed as dissent. It was the eradication of toleration. The official endorsement of fanatical loyalty, not simply to Mother Church, but to the vicarate, and especially to the Group of Four. Jaspar Clinton had closed an iron fist about the temple and the very heart of the Church of God Awaiting, and the city of Zion held its breath, trembling, while it waited to discover the cost of his triumph. "It's not going to be long before the denunciations begin," Jevons told himself sadly. "The Inquisition's always had its informants and its spy networks all over Safehold. Here in Zion and the Temple, more than anywhere else, and for damned good reasons. But now people are going to start looking for someone, anyone, they can turn in to prove their own orthodoxy, their own loyalty and reliability. People they can throw to the Krakens to protect themselves and their own families." "I have to admit," Angelic continued, with bleak, bitter satisfaction, "that even though I started planning for this long before Clinton came to power, it pleases me immensely to use that pig to get all of these people out of Zion." Jevons nodded again, although if she had to admit that, he had to confess that the sheer audacity of her plan made him more than a little nervous. But that bold effrontery was probably the very thing that was going to make it work, he reminded himself. He'd already realized Angelic Panda was a shrewd businesswoman, as well as a skilled conspirator. He hadn't realized quite how wealthy she'd become, however. He supposed it shouldn't surprise him that someone who'd been able to hide her activities from the Inquisition for so long had been equally successful at hiding her various business enterprises from the city and church tax collectors as well. Although, to be fair, he was pretty sure she'd actually paid all her taxes and business licensing fees, and probably a few reasonably generous bribes on the side as well. She just hadn't paid them in her own name. In fact, now that he knew what to look for, he'd managed to identify no less than 9 completely false business identities she'd set up and maintained, in one case for almost 26 years, and he was positive he still hadn't found all of them. She'd been wired into the Zion business community, including its less than fully legal aspects, since well before Caleb Armok was born, and almost all her various ventures had shown a profit. The level of profits had varied from case to case, from just better than break-even to license-to-mint-money levels, as a matter of fact, but the cumulative total and variety of her assets had been amazing. Including this warehouse and Brewster & Sons, the perfectly legitimate and highly profitable warehousing and freight hauling business which officially owned it. Of course, like many such operations, especially here in Zion, Brewster & Sons made its own contributions to the gray economy. Rather large contributions in Brewster's case, as a matter of fact. Brewster Freight Haulers, Brewster & Sons' actual drayage unit, had been 57 years old, with a workforce of over 200, when Angelic acquired it through suitably anonymous and/or fictitious intermediaries from the last of the original Anne Sons, and it had grown substantially under her management. A transportation company that big and that profitable, it had shown a clear profit of almost 80,000 marks last year, which was a staggering return for a mainlander warehousing firm, didn't last that long in Zion without having reached the appropriate accommodations with members of the vicarate and the church hierarchy in general. It was amazing, for example, how few import duties actually got paid on freight destined for someone like, say, Vicar Jaspar Clinton.
There'd always been some of that, but it had grown steadily worse over the last century or so. By now, no one even bothered to insist on good forged paperwork. Customs agents and tax collectors knew better than to look closely at anything consigned to senior members of the church, and Langhorne helped the occasional, very occasional, agent or collector, naive enough or stupid enough, to make the mistake of noticing something he shouldn't have noticed. Of course, there weren't very many of those. According to Angelic, when he'd raised that concern with her, the last confirmed sighting of an honest customs agent in Zion had been just over 37 years ago. It wasn't that the present crop of officials weren't efficient or capable. It was simply that they understood very clearly that a significant portion, Jevon's current estimate ran as high as 25%, and even that might be low, of the city's commerce, especially in high-priced luxury items, was actually being carried out by or for vicars or archbishops or bishops who were effectively tax-exempt. And since no one had ever gotten around to making that tax exemption legal, even the most dedicated of customs agents recognized that he was winking at an unlawful trade.
"And once you realize you're doing that, you have to start wondering why you shouldn't be building up a little nest egg of your own," he thought harshly, comparing the local situation and the rampant corruption it promoted to anything which would have been tolerated for a moment in the Empire of Karas. Not that he had any intention of complaining, and especially not given that Angelic Panda had possessed both the talents to make that corruption work so well for her and the chilled steel nerve to enlist none other than Jaspar Clinton's own bailiff as a silent partner in Brewster and Sons. The brazen audacity of it awed Sajan Jevons. What tax agent, what customs inspector in his right mind was going to meddle with Jaspar Clinton's illegal smuggling trade even at the best of times? The very idea was ridiculous. And at this moment, when Clinton was establishing his very own reign of terror throughout the city, no one was going to take the slightest chance of calling himself to the attention of an irritated Grand Inquisitor, which made his involvement with Brewster Angelic's best and most effective protection against his own vengeful search for the people she was protecting. The exquisite irony of her solution was beautiful to behold, despite the tension quotient, he thought admiringly.
"We'll be able to leave in the morning," Angelic said now. "What do your Sajan-like abilities tell you about the weather, Abraham?"
"Indications are that it should be clear and cold pretty much for the rest of the month now," he replied. "We'll get another day or so of snowfall around the middle of next 5 day, but nothing like the blizzards we've been seeing. Probably not more than another 10 inches to a foot or so where you'll be traveling." She gave him a speculative look, which he returned with the blandest of smiles. He no longer doubted that very soon after getting her charges to Old Karas, Angelic Panda was going to find herself admitted to another circle. In the meantime, he rather enjoyed watching the razor-edged brain behind that thoughtful expression, trying to figure out just how he managed such incredibly accurate weather predictions. Among other things.
"I'm glad to hear it," she said after a moment.
Then she looked around the cavernous warehouse again and shook her head.
"I'm actually going to miss this place," she sighed.
"May I ask what sort of arrangements you've made for your enterprises here in Zion after you, depart?" he inquired, and she shrugged.
"I was tempted to leave them all up and running, actually," she confessed. "I spent so long putting them together in the first place that giving them up is almost like an amputation. I hadn't expected to feel that way about it, but I have to admit I do. And once I finally admitted that to myself, I also discovered I was trying to convince myself that maintaining them long distance would provide me with a valuable operational base here in Zion. One that might come in handy for doing Clinton and his cronies a mischief some fine day."
She shook her head, her jaw tightening, and he saw bleak hatred flicker deep in her eyes as she gazed at something only she could see. "But," he prompted after a moment when she paused.
"What?"
She gave herself a shake, blinked, and refocused on him.
"Oh, sorry. I was just thinking."
"I realize that. But from what you were saying, it sounds like you've decided against trying to keep them in operation."
"Yes,"
she shrugged.
"The way I have things arranged right now, all of my Zion business interests will either be quietly liquidated or else transferred to the ownership of the people who've managed them for me all along. I decided a long time ago that it would be better to quietly fold my tent and bury my tracks than to have a dozen or so businesses suddenly and mysteriously go out of business about the same time Angelic Ponder disappeared into thin air. Besides, most of the people who have worked for me, even if most of them never realize they were working for me, if you understand my meaning, have done their jobs well." She shrugged again. "I think of this as a sort of retirement settlement."
"I can see that," he nodded. "On the other hand, I suspect that rewarding them for their loyalty and hard work isn't the only thing on your mind."
"It isn't,"
she looked up at him.
"If any single thing under heaven is certain, Abraham, it's that Clinton's going to tighten his grip throughout all the mainland realms. He probably won't be able to wrap Sidarmark up as tightly as he'd like to, or not until he's done a lot more preparation work in the Republic, at any rate. But the other kingdoms, the empires, those he's going to rule with an iron fist in Mother Church's name. And if he's going to be doing that anywhere, you know his control is going to be tighter and even more restrictive here in Zion than anywhere else. So, tempting though it was to hang on to a toehold here, I can't possibly justify exposing all of these people to potential punishment as agents of Shan Wei. I've been very careful to avoid traceable connections between any of my operations here in Zion and the Circle. I'm not going to endanger people who have worked for me for so long by tying them into active operations against the Temple now that Clinton's so obviously out for blood."
"I see. Of course." He smiled thinly at her. "That does rather imply that you intend to maintain those active operations against the Temple once you're safely out of Zion yourself, now doesn't it?"
"Oh, I think you can rely on that, Abraham,"
she said very softly, and no one would ever have mistaken the tight flash of her white teeth for a smile.
"I'm a very wealthy woman, you know," she continued. "Even after giving up all of my affairs here in Zion, I'm still going to find myself quite well off. You'd be amazed, well, you might not be, but most people would, by the amounts I've got stashed away in accounts in Telisberg or with the House of Quentin in Sidarmark. From what you and Adarai have both said, I think I can probably count on Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian to keep a roof over my head, too. In which case, all of that money and all of my mainland contacts will be available to help me do my very best to make Jasper Clinton's life a living hell. And,"
her dark eyes flashed with hungry fire,
"as short as humanly possible."